And welcome back to another episode of the Sideline Experts. Ned and I are absolutely thrilled this week because we are joined with
more than thrilled.
We're ecstatic. We are joined by an absolute legend of the game and one who boasts probably as impressive a rugby CV, if not a CV in general, as you can find. We're talking 100 Queensland caps, 72 test caps, 15 as captain, a Super 6 championship, two Super 10 championships, three Bledisloe Cups, a Grand Slam, and a World Cup. We're joined by none other than Michael Liner. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks, Ned. Nice to be here on a Friday night in Brisbane.
Hey, Michael, what I will say to lead off is that two of us have worn the mighty first 15 jersey for Gregory Terrace at number 10. So, you know, look, we'll let the viewers and listeners decide who went better. But, I'm in illustrious class there.
No, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the... I'll probably go out and watch Terrace play in a couple of weeks, I think, once we get out of here. So it should be good to get back out to Tennyson and have a look at the first 15 go around again.
Love to hear it. Love to hear it. And you join us from hotel quarantine, I understand, Michael. And I take it with Queensland Rugby's newest roster announcement, Tom Liner, your son. That must be pretty crazy for you to, you know, have your son following a path you know all too well.
Although it was a long time ago that I sort of ran around Ballymore. But, you know, Tom's, he signed up late last year, and it's an exciting new chapter for him, and one that he's really looking forward to getting his teeth into next week once we clear quarantine here. And it was a big decision for him to make, to change. He's lived over in the Northern Hemisphere all his life, and to say, you know, I'm going to go out to Australia and to Brisbane and to play rugby straight out of schools, quite a big move, but one that he's very excited about, and I guess he's really looking forward to. So we'll see how he goes.
Yeah, great to hear. And obviously, he's eligible for Australia, Italy, and England. What made him pursue the path over here, over following in his older brother's footsteps and carving a path in the English club system or in Italy?
It was his call. He seems to like, he said he likes the way the style of rugby down here, the harder and faster grounds would suit the way he sort of likes to play. And I think it's a bit of an adventure for him to,
for sure.
You know, as he says, it's like a, you know, everybody goes away in a gap year when life was a little bit more normal. And while it's a little bit more important that he performs and doesn't do what students do on gap year most of the time, but I think there's a little bit of that, a little bit of adventure for him, a great opportunity and one that he's very excited about and looking forward to taking up. But as I said, it's a big big step for him, a brave decision to make, but which ones that, you know, we've always supported. We've got three boys, and we've always supported whatever they wanted to do along the way. And Tom said, that's what I want to do. So we're supporting him in that, and hopefully does really well.
And Michael, obviously when you left school, you made the decision. Well, it's funny the way you've described it previously. You're a cricket nerd and cricket tragic by heart, and you end up playing for Queensland first year out of school. And am I right in saying that a big part of that is because of Roger Gould staying over in Italy post tour, and that's why there was a spot open in that first year for you?
That sort of, the cards fell my way in that regard. But prior to that, you mentioned cricket. My first summer out of school was spent on the Australian Rugby Schoolboys Tour. We went to the Northern Hemisphere and played up there for, December, January. So that's the first summer out of school that I would have been able to play cricket, and I was away on a rugby tour. So that sort of put me on the path towards rugby, I guess, because when I came back from that, it was pre-season time here, and I started playing out at uni. And three games into playing first grade at uni, I was selected for Queensland. And you're right, Roger had decided to stay overseas, and Paul McLean at the time, who was the 10 for Queensland, was moved to fullback, and I was given the opportunity to play 10 And it was quite an amazing experience, I must say, because I was the only person in the whole squad. That first game, I'll never forget, against Wairarapa Bush, I was the only person in the whole squad, reserved included, that hadn't played for Australia.
Wow.
And I always remember it was trying to fit into the back line. It was just such a well-oiled machine, and it was a pretty amazing experience to do that.
Yeah, and you touched obviously on especially Paul McLean, who no doubt is a legend of Queensland rugby. How instrumental in that star-studded lineup do you think those sort of figures were in developing you into that playmaking role so well?
They were very welcoming, and it was, you know, like any good fly half, or any fly half, actually doesn't matter what level you're at, but you always, first of all, you look at your halfback, see whether he's able to pass the ball or not. And second, and more importantly, you look at your forward pack and think they're pretty solid up there. So
yeah.
I had sort of pretty good ones in that regard. I think the two halfbacks for Queensland at the time were Guy Sanders and Tony Parker, both Australian players. Yeah. And the forward
another terrace boy in there as well.
Tony Parker, yeah. And so I also played with him at university as well. So that was a good sort of combination there. But the forward pack had people like Mark Lone, David Hillhouse, Tony Shaw. You know, it was an Australian forward pack. So it made my job a little easier. And then people around you, you mentioned Paul, who was fantastic, and I'm still pretty close to when I speak to him. Not regularly, but every now and then. And also Andrew Slack, who was in the back line, Brendan Moon, Michael O'Connor. It was a pretty good back line, but also just so open and welcoming to me, and assisted me in a lot. So while Paul was very helpful, the rest of them were as well. It was a great experience.
And it's funny, you touch on your career, Michael, and one of the things that was probably, you know, more common back then as an amateur was players worked and studied or as part of their rugby career. You know, you'd train it after you finish work, and it's almost come full circle because, you know, through the 90s and early 2000s, we had players who were trying to embrace that ultra professionalism, and they couldn't get enough of the game. They're going home, they're watching videos, they're doing their rehab, they're waking up extra early in the morning to do the same, and then they go to training. It's that revolving door of professionalism. We now are sort of at the other end of that spectrum, and we're seeing a lot of young players have significant interests outside of the game. So, you know, whether it's they're studying at university or building small businesses. We've got Angus Scott Young here in Brisbane, who's, you know, developed his own small little clothing company. What do you make of the ability to switch off from the game? Because in your era, switching off from the game was compulsory because you had a full-time job. Now, players are looking to make that switch because they're so tied up in the detail of football.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting observation. And rugby, when it first went professional, it sort of everybody was trying to work out, what does that mean? Does that mean I have to go to the training ground at 9 o'clock and come home at 5? and in some cases, that's what people did. That's what teams did in some cases, because nobody really knew. And, you know, this is 25 years ago now, but it's still what I would call a reasonably young sport in terms of professionalism. And while we've come a long way since, you know, that 96 sort of period when it first went professional. And, you know, I've always encouraged and think it's a really healthy thing for professional sports people, not only rugby players, but rugby players, let's talk about them, you know, that have outside interests, because I think it makes you a more rounded person for a start. When you have other interests other than just waking up and going to training and, you know, everything you do is about rugby. That's important, right? But there's other things as well.
Yep.
And I think to have interests outside rugby is a really important thing. So I'd encourage it. And I think most organisations now, professional rugby organisations, are encouraging that, as long as it doesn't affect what your day job is, which is to be a rugby player. But I think it can be healthy mentally, and, you know, having a release and having other interests, you know, like at school, you know, you look back at school, and I always found when I was at school at Terrace that you know, the more I had on, the more organized I was.
Right.
And if I had sport to do, you know, if I'm playing cricket or rugby season was on, I found that, you know, homework and schoolwork and all that sort of thing, I was much more organized because you had to be. There wasn't a much time. You know what it's like when you've got spare day tomorrow, I'll do it tomorrow, you know. Whereas if you have to do it in that hour and a half that you've got spare, you do it. And it's the old adage, you know, always if you want something done, ask a busy person because they're well organized. So I think it's a healthy thing. I really do. And I'd be very encouraged because also from a professional rugby point of view, we're not like American footballers or English football players or whatever that actually, you know, they can retire and if they're sensible, they can probably go and sit on the beach for the rest of their lives. Rugby's not like that. You know, you retire at 30, 34. You know, you've got a few years to go to actually earn some money and live. And, you know, if you've sort of started playing rugby when you're 18 years of age, you don't know anything else. And so I'd encourage all rugby players to try and get out and take the opportunities and take the time that you've got to learn and have other interests.
Yeah, and obviously we touched on that transition point, which you're a part of between the amateur and the professional game. Obviously, a lot of people around your time were lured by this idea of rugby league, potentially a lot of contracts thrown around to the union talent. Was that ever something which was on your radar at all, Michael?
Yes, it was. And, you know, I was a big fan of rugby league when I was back playing and, you know, used to follow it. And it's been interesting coming back to Australia over the last 2 weeks, you know, sitting and watching the rugby league here a little bit. And also during lockdown last year, rugby league, I think the NRL was the only sport, live sport on in the world. So my sons and I would sit down and watch it and sort of so started to get back into it. But it's, in terms of contracts and offers and that sort of thing, they came. And there was a particularly one that was quite a big one from St. Helens over in the UK. And I remember sitting down and talking with my father with it a bit. I was sort of pretty tempted, actually, because it was a lot of money and in those days. And I sort of looked at it and said, you know, I've got a pretty good job here at the time. I think I was vice captain or of both Queensland and Australia, you know, and was playing and enjoying things pretty well with both work and the rugby. And, you know, I'd go surfing and like the beach and the weather here in Queensland and all that sort of stuff. And I think Dad said, would you like to give that all up and go and play in St. Helens at a game that you don't really know whether you'd like or be any good at? Up in the north of England, five winters in a row. If you put it like that, maybe not.
Well, it's funny. Michael O'Connor, obviously, who you mentioned you played with, he transitions and becomes one of the, you know, great outstanding outside backs in rugby league. And we chatted with Tim Horan last year, and he said he had very similar offers to you. And one of the things I get perplexed about in rugby league at the moment is they talk about halves running the football. And I'm going to circle around in a long way here to your try against Ireland in the World Cup in the quarterfinal. Now, you, in that try, push around the ball and Campisi makes a small offload and you pick it up off the bottom of your feet and score it over. One of the things I think is common now, and Robert Finch here, who's a rugby league legend here in Australia, made the comment of ball players in general that when they are asked to run the football, it's not merely about running and getting tackled and moving the ball. It's more so about pushing up on every play and as a playmaker being involved on every single play. And that example of you in that game against Ireland in 91 in the quarters is a perfect example of, sure, you made the initial pass, but you pushed up on the play, you supported on the play, and there you are to score. What I'm getting at here is, sometimes that natural football instinct is lost in the way that we structure football, not just in rugby league. I see it a lot in rugby union now. Do you still think we teach skills and game sense, or does it sometimes become we see what professionals are doing and we try to teach that to our kids?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I remember when we first started, I think it was back in the early 90s, and Bob Dwyer was the Australian coach then, and we tried to move on from where we got to after winning the World Cup in 91 to try and go to the what's the next stage in rugby. And Bob was sort of one of the first to try and sort of have three or four phases in a row that were planned. You know, you'd have a scrum and there'd be a blindside back row move, and then the forwards would come back and then they'd run here and then the backs would do this. And so you had this structure around four plays, and that's all very good when you're doing it at training and there's no opposition or very little opposition. But as soon as somebody does something or gets tackled or the opposition gets in the way, lo and behold, there's an opposition there. That four sort of phases then breaks down, and we're all standing around, we're going, what do we do now? So there was teething sort of problems with it back then, but now we see it much, much more structured. And I sometimes think that, you know, the way to break down these very good defences in professional rugby now is that you've almost got to create a little bit of chaos and a little bit of uncertainty. And some of the successful teams that I see at the moment, that's very much the case. And it's not about, you know, they play within a structure, but there's a lot of flexibility within that structure as to what the opposition's doing. And that's, I see as now the next phase of how we develop the game, because defenses have become so good that they can sort of keep a structure out. But if you start breaking that up and doing the unexpected, or something different, then defences sort of get asked questions, and sometimes they make a mistake, and that's where the opportunity is. So, it's an interesting one, and I never liked sort of being told that, Michael, now you, in phase two you have to go there and you have to do this and you have to pass it to him. It was, you know, probably because I played 10 years before that of just sort of reading the play and doing, you know, making decisions on the run, and people around me used to doing that, to actually being having this structured thing where if the opposition's not in front of you, I'm not supposed to run straight through that hole. I've got to pass it to them because that's the move we've got to do. So, it was an interesting one. But, yes, I think rugby's got to evolve now where we've got to start almost. You saw Harlequins over in the Premiership in England this year. They started playing a very unstructured way of playing. Yeah, and it was very exciting to watch. But they said, oh, you know, they just throw the ball around and it's, you know, they just, you know. And actually, when you look at it, some basic principles, they kicked a lot. They kicked, so did the All Blacks. They kicked more than most other teams.
Yep.
But when they do get the ball, it's sort of in broken phase and away they go. Harlequins were a bit the same, but there was two basic rugby premises that were the foundation of Harlequin's win. And one was they were very fit, so they could keep running and break the opposition down because of fatigue. And the second one was they had a very good forward pack and very good set piece. So there was, you know, that's a basic rugby foundation. If you have that, you can build all this other stuff around it. And you know, while it looked lovely and it was, you know, it almost looked like a Harlem Globetrotters sort of thing, there was the foundation was the forward pack, had really good scrum, good line out, very strong. You know, so I think that's a really interesting way of play. And then you see the Lions and the South African series, and it's the total antithesis.
Almost fell asleep when that was on.
And there was no rugby played, right?
No
one took a chance.
Yeah,
the only time either team took a chance is when the referee gave an advantage, you know, a knock-on or a penalty advantage, and that's when the only time they passed the ball. And I just found that, you know, it's almost this when we're not going to lose by making any mistakes. I just found that a really disappointing series to watch.
Yeah, and it's interesting you touch on that too, Michael, because we talk a lot on this podcast about where rugby's at as a game. And when you look particularly at that second test where I think it was 25 minutes support was in play, which is just abysmal, particularly for an Australian sports market when you're looking on and you want rugby to be competitive. Mm. And then I kind of correlate that with you were involved, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, with Andrew Forrest when he was talking a bit about this World Series rugby concept and making it more appealing, the product we've got today. So if in bearing that in mind, how do you think today we can kind of stamp that out and make rugby a more desirable product that we can market to the masses?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. Well, what we did with with Andrew and his global rapid rugby was to try and speed the whole game up. So, you know, scrums were done very quickly, lineouts were done quickly, you know, and referees were instructed to move people along and do it. So therefore fatigue becomes a factor as well. We also had, amongst other things, the main one was the sort of, I think it was ended up being 9-point try. So if you initiate a movement in your own 22 and you end up scoring, it's worth 9 points. So there's incentive there, but it also makes it risky. And you turn the ball over and the opposition, you know. So it's sort of, you know, there's some fundamental things like that. And it might be sound a little bit, you know, a bit corny or trying to do something. But rugby can be a wonderful game when it's played well and played with ambition and you know, taking a little bit of risk. As opposed to what we saw in the South African Lions game, where it was just sort of attritional and nobody was taking any risk, and it can't be. While winning is lovely, and that's what the South Africans will say, they're playing to their strength and they win.
Yeah.
Well, fair enough, and they found a way to win both the World Cup and the Lions series. So, you know, that's terrific. But I just feel that the only way to sort of really no, it can't be all that pleasant to play in, although winning is great and you're happy and all that sort of thing. But, to not have any ambition in that regard and to try and go and win a match as to try and not to lose a match, I just feel that's the wrong attitude. So, you know, if you have coaches and players that are buying into this whole sort of thing that we're just going to go out and, you know, the idea of the game is to score tries. That's the objective of the game. Let's go and do that. And our defence, yes, we'll defend and we'll organise all that. But our main reason for playing this game is to try and go and score tries and in so doing win the game.
Yeah, yeah. And with that in mind, it's interesting because my favourite innovation that you guys kind of came up with was that banning, and it's probably unpopular to a lot of fly halves, I imagine, the banning of the exiting on the full from the 22. I thought that was something of real promise. And when you consider that lineouts make up for about a third of all stoppages in the game and probably exits from the 22, 50% of those, that's a massive amount of time that we can inject to excel fatigue. So, yeah, I'd love to see something like that definitely come to fruition.
Yeah, that was, and it just, yes, you can kick, you can still kick, but it does promote sort of, well, you know, you've got to find other ways of getting out of your own sort of 22 now. You know, it's quite an interesting concept, but it's more like, you know, just speeding this up. And the last thing we want to see is, you know, scrum after scrum collapsing, and you've got, you know, 4 minutes of scrums and then a penalty or a free kick, and we'll scrum again. You know, so it's like, come on. And I've always sort of thought, you know, that while
spoken like a true fly half, I might add.
Yeah, exactly. But most supporters don't want to watch that. Yeah. They really don't. Yeah. I just want to see play. Let's come on, do some play.
Yeah.
And when a scrum, I've always thought that the best way to do this, it's so difficult to understand whose fault it is that the scrum's gone down. And I often think that the referee should be given license to say, I'm going to penalize one of you. If you go down, if the scrum goes down, I'm going to panel. I might get it wrong, so keep it up. So put the onus back on the players, right? Because funnily enough, if they know they're going to get penalised, they'll keep it up. So they'll keep that up. So put it on the players. You know, the referee says, "I'm going to penalise one of you, and I'll get it wrong, but that's not my fault. That's yours. So keep it up." So I think the way you sort of tell referees or instruct them how to referee, you know. You know, reset, penalty, reset. You know, it's just like, come on, get on with it. Anyway, that is a fly half talking, I guess.
I agree.
It is a fan who doesn't want to watch four scrums in a row and then a free kick and then the captain go, "We'll have another scrum, please."
Yeah. And then we'll try to shot a goal or something.
Yeah.
Michael, I do want to touch on kicking and in particular goal kicking. Obviously, you were Australia's first choice kicker for much of your career, in particular, the emphasis on that 87 Grand Slam tour and predominantly why you were picked at 12 in that side. Your relationship with goal kicking is quite an interesting one. Obviously, you're a lover of golf, and I think there's some quite large similarities between the way you players kick goals and sort of play golf. It's sort of a goal kicking itself is a sort of selfish act inside a huge team sport. And I think I've heard you describe it a few times that your dad helped you use a lot of visualization techniques. And then later in your career, when you became a professional, a lot of players' contracts were tied to score margins and points, and you felt the pressure in those situations. The one thing I'm sort of touching on here is it's funny that rugby is such a team game, but there are so many individual moments where pressure is put on one individual. And I just want to ask, like, how did you cope with that, particularly being like the star player of the Australian team? And obviously in that 87 series, one of the games you don't kick goals, and then you come back and kick goals later in the series. How do you manage that internally within a group?
Yeah, it's you're right. Rugby is a everybody says it's a great team sport, and it is. But within that team sport, you have goal kicking is a very individual thing, and nobody else can do it for you. I guess the only other thing in rugby is throwing the ball into the line out. I mean, the hookers do it. They don't have to, but that's just what the hooker, you're going to do that. And that's a pretty tough thing as well to do, under pressure. So, but the goal kicking, yes, it's quite a strange one. You're an individual in a team sport, and the pressure on that was quite a lot. I mean, intense, really, because I wouldn't be too much, before a game I used to get terribly nervous, but it wasn't so much about, you get nervous about how you're going to play and the result and all that sort of thing. But I'd get most nervous about the goal kicking. And had I not been a goal kicker, I probably could have played a little bit longer, but my nerves were, don't know about that, but during the amateur time, I think most of the nerves came about by the fact that it was around. You didn't know how you're going to hit the ball that day, because you hadn't had enough time because you were working and that sort of thing to go and actually practice. It's a bit like you get up on the first tee and you haven't practiced or hit a golf ball for a month. How's this going to go?
Even when I do practice, it's like that.
But if it goes down the middle, you think, oh, that's good. It's going to be a good day. If you hook it out to the left, oh, God, here we go again. So goal kicking is a little bit like that in the amateur year. You mishit the first kick and it goes to the right, and then the next one goes to the left. You overcompensate, and all of a sudden you're none for two, and the pressure builds.
Yeah.
And then you're right, when I went into professional rugby, a lot of bonuses and all that sort of win bonuses and all that, I had a big say in that, being the goal kicker. So that was a different type of pressure. But the difference was that I handled it a lot better because I was able to practice. I wasn't doing anything else. And lo and behold, my percentages went up, and I felt a lot more confident going into the game around goal kicking because I'd practiced it. And I felt, I was hitting it really well this week. And you go into the game, you just knew that it was going to be a bit better than it was back in the amateur days, where it was just like, well, I hope it's a good day today. I've been a goal kicker since I was at Terrace, since I was, 11 years old, 10 years old. So it was a long time doing that. And it was a bit, I always used to have the cricket analogy, you might goal kick really well, but the team loses. I'd rather kick none out of six and the team wins. Wasn't ever about, it was about the team trying to get across the line. So if I could, I remember in Wellington once, windy Wellington, I used to hate kicking there, the old athletic park, on top of a hill, and it was like a wind tunnel. And I kicked so badly. Well, badly. It was just impossible to kick. But I scored two tries and we won the game. So the guy asked me about my goal kicking afterwards, and I said, look, I don't really care. I found another way to score some points, and we found another way of winning the game. So I was quite proud of that, actually. It's like, you might get out for a duck in cricket, then go and take three catches and win the match that way.
Yeah.
So there's different ways of skinning it.
Yeah, definitely. One kick I'll touch on that you did make in New Zealand to much fortune that's often touted was that, I think it was 1986, the Alan Jones calls it to the kick for the last 10 minutes of the Bledisloe to win it. And Alan Jones says it was the kick that determined the fate of the series. You've obviously had a lot of kicks like that in your career, but is there any one that stands out to you?
Thankfully, not too many.
true. But is there any one kick that stands out through your whole career that you're just like, wow, I still get shakes just thinking about it to this day, the pressure and the how inordinately huge the moment was?
That was a big one, and I wasn't very demonstrative on the field, you know, jumping up and down and all that sort of stuff. But I remember sort of giving it a little, when that went through, gave it a little fist pump because it was, you know, I knew that was the kick that won the game. I knew we were going to win the game then. And we were in front at the time, I think, but I think that just put us another score out from memory. There was a couple that come to mind. One, I'll do them chronologically. One was in 84, and I hadn't been kicking well against England or Ireland. And then Roger Gould took over the kicking against Wales and kicked very well. And then I was reinstated for the Scottish test. And I did a lot of work on the goal kicking. And I remember I think I got six out of seven that day or something. And it was just, I was hitting it so beautifully. I could have put it anywhere. I could have put it in up in row Z and kicked it from there. It was just one of those days. So I remember that was a great day. And I sort of overcome some problems before that I'd worked out and had a really good day to win that, and that was a grand slam. We were never in doubt. It was just nice to have a good performance. And then in 91, the English against England in the World Cup final, that was a pretty pressurized sort of game. And I've always sort of had the habit of going to the ground the day before and having a bit of a kick and a look around. And I remember going to Twickenham the day before on the Friday. And because it's sort of like it's a different stadium now, they've rebuilt it all. But in those days, there was old stands and there used to be sort of wind coming through the corners. And you'd look at the flags on the pitch and they were sort of going one way. And then you'd feel the wind and it's going another way. And I worked it out, the wind would come in and hit the stands and swirl around. Mm. So I remember kicking that day before the World Cup final, and I'd feel the wind and it was coming off a stand this way, for example. And so I'm going, okay, I'll aim it right. And all of a sudden the ball goes up in the air and it goes to the right rather than going from right to left.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's weird. And I worked out the wind. And the next day I missed the first one quite badly, but then I had a similar kick to the one I was practicing the day before. And I thought, I've just got to trust myself here. So I'm looking at the flags and they're telling me to do one thing. The wind of feelings telling me to do another. And I just thought, you know that you learned your lesson yesterday, so just trust it. And I did it and it worked. And I just thought, you know, preparation, here you go, you know, because had I just ran out into that field, I would have missed the kick because I hadn't worked out the wind. And so that was a big occasion. I think I got 3 out of 4 or something like that. Mm. But it's funny, actually, I was watching the game with my kids a couple of years ago. We hadn't watched, I'd never watched it. And I remember as a family, we sat down to watch it and the kids were complaining and all that sort of thing. And the first kick was sort of like about, I think it was about 40 yards out on the right. And, you know, the commentator's going, well, you know, this will test Liner's nerves and it's a big occasion. And one of my sons said, do you get this, Dad? And I said, I honestly don't remember. And I didn't. Anyway, I basically blocked it over cover. You know, I missed it by 15 yards. And my son just looked at me and went, oh, that's embarrassing, Dad. That's embarrassing. But then I got the rest, so that was all right.
Hey, we're fast running out of time. One of the last things I want to touch on is the ticker tape parade post the World Cup victory. I think it's one of these, every time they run these sorts of things, all the players of whatever sport it is, they have this feeling inside their stomach that says, no one's going to show up. No one cares. But you go to that parade and people are lining the streets. Does that really allow you to understand the magnitude of what that victory meant?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, you're right. We thought, well, this is going to be a bit embarrassing. You know, our parents and our brothers and sisters might turn up. It was an amazing occasion. And I think we're at that time, we were lucky in terms of rugby in Australia. There was not really any other sport going on at that time. Cricket season hadn't really got into full swing. So it sort of captured the imagination of the country. And, it was a great bonus for Australian rugby to, have that happen. And, it's lovely memories riding around there and all these people. And it was good to get the team back together as well. It was often after these tours and things like that, we land and we all go back to our different sort of states and all that sort of thing and, go on summer holidays and that sort of stuff. So it was actually nice to have everyone back together.
Yeah, certainly. And obviously you touch on that glorious moment for Australian rugby in 91. Obviously it's been a little bit of a drought since then, but when we look to the game today, we've obviously been through in this COVID era, this huge age of disruption for rugby, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. I'm not sure if you've seen the recent leaked reports in the media about the new Tasman future, but are you happy with the direction the code is taking in the last few years to really reverse and buck some of these trends?
Well, I think we've got a long way to go in Australia, but we all know that. And I think there's a lot of people that are working very hard to try and turn it around. And I actually think if you look into the future of Australian rugby, there's, we've got the prospects of a Lions tour in 4 years' time. We've got the prospect of a Rugby World Cup coming back to here. They're two mighty occasions for rugby. On a global scale, and they're bankable sort of occasions. And so if we can just get over this next 4 years and come out of it with good direction, a good foundation, and, and I mean right from ground up, you think of the club game in both Brisbane and Sydney at the moment, it, from what I understand, pre-COVID, et cetera, and even now, it's pretty healthy. So that's a good sign. There's people out there that want to see rugby thrive and do well. Getting it back into the schools, getting junior clubs along the way, amateur clubs along the way, and just having that whole feeder network coming through. And if we can get over this hump with getting some good things in place, some good structures in place, we've got two big occasions, sort of Rugby World Cup would be great, but we've got to get it yet. But there's two big occasions like that that we actually can, once that happens, it'd be fantastic. We've just got to get there.
No, I agree. And Michael, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to leave it on a nice positive note to finish and hope you survive hotel quarantine.
I'm sure we will. We've got 4 days to go, so we're looking forward to getting out, but it hasn't been too bad. The hotel's been pretty good, and but I'm keen to get out in the real world again.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Michael.
Holy Tamora. Good. Bloody, you beauty.